We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
The centrepiece of Christianity is the cross of Jesus. The most important festivity of the Christian year is Easter, the celebration of the death and resurrection of Jesus. The centre point of Israel before Jesus, the centre point of the Old Testament as opposed to the New Testament, is the Exodus. The main and great feast really is that of the Passover, which celebrates the 10th of the plagues by which the people of Israel were rescued from Egypt. To understand the Bible, to understand the Gospel, to understand Christianity, to understand Jesus, you in the end have to understand the Exodus. Because the Exodus is the basis of the language of the whole Bible. It's the basis of the language of the salvation of Christianity, of the meaning of what the gospel is all about. The language that God speaks in, not just in terms of Hebrew, in terms of English, but the language in terms of concepts, are the concepts of the Exodus. The salvation, the redemption, the deliverance of the people of God in our generation is all explained in the model of the salvation, the deliverance, the redemption of Israel from slavery in Egypt. The way in which we are saved, it's all there. And while it's described, this Exodus event is described in several books of the Bible, Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, are all dealing with the Exodus. The book called Exodus is the one that really deals with it, the most simple, straightforward and important point of the Exodus, the beginning of it. This is the key. It is really a key book to the opening up of the whole Bible. Now, nowhere is the Exodus event described in non-biblical history. After all, why would it be? The only people who are not Jews who would record it are the Egyptians, and you can't imagine they're going to record a group of runaway slaves, or the Canaanite people who were conquered by the Israelites, and even if they did record it, their whole civilization was destroyed anyway. So there's no way it could be recorded outside of the Bible. But yet it's not to be doubted as to having happened, really, because it has all the intrinsic probability on its side. That is, when you are recording the foundation of your nation, you don't make up a story like the fact that we were the group of people who were the runaway slaves of Egypt. You think of a more noble beginning to your existence. I mean, in the years to come, when people hear that our white nation was established here in Australia as a bunch of convicts sent from the other side of the world, it has the intrinsic probability on its side. Who would make up a story like that, that our nation is made up of convicts? It's the kind of thing that you would hide unless it were true. And then you'd be the kind of pig-headed people who'd be proud of it. That's the character of convicts. Furthermore, it's consistent with what we know of the ancient world. In 1220 BC, an Egyptian pharaoh called Merneptah, 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 set up in his grave a little stele, as it's called, a little monument, a little tablet, talking about all his victories. And one of the victories he declared he had was over the Hebrew people in Canaan. That is, an Egyptian pharaoh is willing to acknowledge the Hebrews as living in Canaan in 1220. It's the first reference to the Hebrews, to the Jewish people, outside of the Bible at all. They were then significantly large in numbers to be known by the pharaoh and were living in Palestine. At that time, they were not a nation or seen to occupy it. We know that Meneptah's father, Ramses, and his grandfather were very great builders of cities in the northern part of Egypt, in the delta of Egypt, which is exactly the place that we find in Exodus chapter 1, the Jews were at work building cities. Indeed, one of the cities, Ramses, that they are said to have built in chapter 1, verse 11, is not known by that name from the time of the 13th century onwards. And it's only in recent archaeological discoveries that we're sure that that is the name of the place. But the Jews continued to record it as the name of the city that they were responsible for building. We also know that during the 13th century, during the 12th century especially, the Palestine was conquered by a primitive peoples who have come in from the desert, destroying all the cities of that period of time. We also know that prior to the 13th century, Moab and Edom didn't exist really as big nations, and so we're able to date the Exodus event as being all in that period of time of about the 13th century BC. That they would have to march around Moab and Edom would be appropriate at that stage in the development, that they would be building big cities in the reign of Ramses fits in with what we know of Ramses, and so on. Now, as a group of people who are going to study the book of Exodus over the next few weeks, we're going to have to work hard. It's not easy for us to wrap our minds around a period of history that is so ancient and unrelated, seemingly, to our culture, with strange concepts and strange history, but it's what we need to do. See, how often have you felt ignorant of the Old Testament? How often have you been in that kind of situation, like a Bible study and so on, and you really are conscious of the fact that you know nothing much before Matthew. You're not too strong from Matthew to Revelation, but you know there's a whole big slab of the Bible, two-thirds of it, of which there's only the slightest memories of a Sunday school lesson you once heard. That there are names running around, Abram, David, Moses, but if you're asked to put them in chronological order, you wouldn't be quite sure, although you think Adam came fairly close to the beginning. We sometimes have had a good enough Sunday school education to know the stories, so we'll know some of the things that Moses did, but how they all connect with each other, we don't know, and how they connect with what Jesus is on about, we don't know. We often see the New Testament quotes or alludes to things in the Old Testament, but the allusion is lost on us because we don't know the Old Testament story well enough. Sometimes we don't even know they are quoting the Old Testament because we don't know the Old Testament story. Well, there's no solution to finding out what the Old Testament's about other than studying it. And that's what we're going to do. Because it is given as God's word to us. It's not just God's word to them. The Bible is the whole the Bible. It's one Bible in the end. It's all God's word. And to rightly understand the New Testament, you must understand the Old Testament. And our inability to know the Old Testament is a very serious weakening in our own Christian faith and understanding. And our grasp of the gospel will be distorted if it's not grasped in its original context. And its original context is the Old Testament. Jesus' Bible was the Old Testament. And Jesus saw that Bible, the Old Testament, as authoritative. And he said, not a jot, not a tittle will pass away till everything is fulfilled. Woe unto anyone who puts aside the least of the commandments of the Old Testament. This is Jesus' Bible, and good enough for him, it should be good enough for us. And if we're to understand the mind of Jesus, we've got to understand this. So we're going to have to work at it. One of the big problems is it comes in large slabs. So tonight we're going to look at four chapters, and we're going to actually have to read it here and now in this gathering so that we can follow it. Next week, if you look on the back of your outline, we're going to be looking at chapters 5 to 9. That's not very much for you to be reading during the course of this week. It's only four or so chapters in this coming week. It's fairly easy reading, actually. It's not hard reading. But it will be tremendous help to our meeting next week and to your appreciation of what you hear next week if you have read those chapters before you come. Even if you remember a Friday afternoon between 6 and 7, you'll still be able to get through those four chapters, but do familiarise yourself with the material because we won't go to the same lengths of reading next week as we're going to this week. We'll skip through it and allude to it and say, you remember this and remember that, because I'm going to assume next week that you have read that, and you'll find the reading helped if you actually answer some of those questions on the back. But I think we'll need tonight, because I didn't warn you about Exodus 1 to 4, although you should have known from the preaching program that you've all picked up at the beginning of the year and you'll get another copy of if you ask for it, that we were going to do it tonight. So on your outline, you'll see chapters 1 to 4 broken into A to H, what's that, 8 different sections. And we're going to read them in turn, or Charlie's going to read them for us bit by bit in turn and make comments about them. And we're going to find out what are the titles that we want to give to them. That's why I've given you no title there, so as to get you actively reading, not just passively sitting there while it's read to you and have a little nap. We've got to work together at seeing what titles we're going to give to them. So let's kick off on the first one, shall we? If Charlie will read for us the first 7 verses of chapter 1. All right, here is the beginning of it. And it all actually goes back to Genesis. Keep your hand in Exodus, turn back to Genesis. If you're turning back, you've hit Genesis immediately. Back to Genesis, to chapter 15, where God speaks to Abram. And I'm reading verse 15:5, Genesis. He took him outside, God took Abram outside, and said to him, "Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." Then he said, "So shall your offspring be." God promised Abram that his children would be as many as the stars in heaven. Come down a little later, verse 13. Then the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sins of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure." Just explain that last verse now. That is, you'll come back to Palestine, to Canaan, because that's where Abraham was at the time. The land that is at the moment, at the time of Abram, occupied by the Amorites. And God is saying, your descendants will come and replace the Amorites, but they can't do it now. They'll only do it when the sins of the Amorites are so great that they deserve to be punished by removal from the land. So in 400 years' time, they'll come back out of slavery, the great multitude of people that I promise you'll have. Now, if we can get the bit of the family tree together. Abram married Sarah. He had other wives, amongst them Keturah. And Abram and Sarah had one son, Isaac, who married Rebekah. Isaac and Rebekah had two sons, Esau and Jacob. Esau became the father of the nation known as Edom. Jacob changed his name, or God changed it for him, to Israel. And he had four wives, accurately two wives and two concubines, who between them produced for him 12 sons, including Joseph. The names of those sons are listed for us in chapter 1 of Exodus, verses 2 and 3 and 4. And wasn't Charlie good? He got them all right there. He didn't have to balk too much at how to pronounce them. When you come to Bible reading, you're always terrified you're going to get a list like that to read, aren't you? If anyone ever asked you to read Matthew 1 publicly, decline. Now, Keturah, the later wife of Abram, became the mother of Midian and the whole Midianites, who are going to be important down the track. All right? The people we're dealing with then are the children of the sons of Israel. They are then the children of Israel. And they are broken up into 12 tribes because Israel, that is Jacob, had 12 sons. And each son is the father of a tribe. And these are called the patriarchs, the fathers of Israel, Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. And you'll often hear of God, the God of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our fathers, who are the God of Israel, the fathers of Israel, and the 12 tribes of Israel. That basic family tree is a necessity to understand the Old Testament. If you haven't got that one right, do take it down and learn it, because you won't make much sense of the rest of the Bible unless you get that bit right. All right? They are going to multiply. And notice what he said there for us in verse 7. They multiplied greatly. They were fruitful, became exceedingly numerous. They were filled, the land was filled. I think it was being an indication that the promise about the stars of heaven is coming true. So I've put down there, as a title for the first of these sections, From Joseph to the Multitude. That's how I took it down as, because it was Joseph who brought them down to the land of Egypt in a famine. You'll find that recorded for you in the book of Genesis, the last few chapters of the book of Genesis. And there he brought down his brothers as well. And so, centuries later, you see, after he had died, they multiplied. Right, while Charlie reads to us the second section, verses 8 to 22, think of the title you're going to be putting down against verses 8 to 22, or write it down, and then compare it with mine and tell me that I'm wrong. All right, what's the title you want to put on that section? Thinking of a title is a great way of keeping your mind concentrated on trying to say, what is it? It's comprehension, you see. One phrase. What are you going to say as a title for this section? Egyptian oppression? Betrayal by Egypt? Yes, because Egypt had promised to be friends of Joseph. The king comes who's forgotten about Joseph, or the dynasty comes. They're betraying their promises, yeah? Enslavement of Israel? Yeah? Any others? Israel enslaved but multiplies, yes? I've gone for Pharaoh's three repressive measures. So as to remind me what they are. There's six of one after the other. See, hard work, but the hard work and the more they're oppressed, the more they multiply. That's why Danny's one's a good one. It could be Pharaoh's three failed repressive measures might be better, mightn't it? The second one is that the midwives were to kill, but they couldn't get there in time. At least that's what they said. And the children of Israel kept multiplying. The third one was the child exposure one. Throw them into the River Nile, right, to kill them, to get rid of them. But they don't work. Now, in chapter 2, we read about one that is thrown into the river, a fine young boy who is born and who's placed in the river by his mother to save him rather than to destroy him. And this is the birth of Moses. I put it down as the birth and preservation of Moses. But notice the ironies that are involved in the story that's read for us. Charlie, why don't you go for chapter 2, verses 1 to 10. Fabulous fun involved in it, isn't it? It's a story that's too well known for us to laugh, but you can see the enjoyment that the Jews used to get around the fireside as they told the story. Because the Egyptians, verse 22 of chapter 1, were to throw the children into the Nile. The Jewish lady put her child into the Nile and the Egyptian drew him out. And then got the Jewish woman to raise the child, to wet nurse the child, to feed the child, and of joy, paid her for the privilege of feeding her own child. It's an early mother care system that has come in. So that they were now paid to preserve the child that the Egyptians were supposed to, and of all places, it's in the very house of Pharaoh where this child is to be raised. It's a special one indeed. And that warning has come that that's going to be special for the rest of the story, of course. Moses. Well, Moses has grown to adulthood between verses 10 and 11. You don't hear anything about his childhood now. But as an adult, we hear about him in his very first important steps in his life's work. So I want to read verses 11 to 22, and then you can give me the title that you'd go for on this one. All right, what are we going to call it? This side answered all the questions last time. Oh, no, Danny did too, yes. What are we going to call it? Exile of Moses. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what other ones we come for? Moses, eviction and re-establishment. Mm-hmm. Joe? Moses rejected. Yeah? Over this side, you want to add something? In and out of trouble. Mm-hmm. Getting out of trouble was family life. Zipper is a dreadful name, isn't it? And I think only since the invention of the zipper. I don't think it would have been a bad name before that. All right, well, I've gone for Moses, the rejected liberator. You see, he actually takes an intentional action for justice and liberation of the people Hebrew, of the Hebrew people. He identifies himself, verse 11 and 12, with the Hebrews. And when he saw this Hebrew being unjustly oppressed, he sought to rescue him by intentionally killing the Egyptian. You see, he looks both ways, glancing this way and that way, and seeing no one. I mean, that is not a got carried away at the moment. That's not the heat of the argument. That's actually murder. That's first degree. It's premeditated. That's the character of it. He purposely actually killed this person so as to rescue. But notice the man said to him in verse 14, "Who made you ruler and judge over us?" He is rejected as the... But of course, the irony comes in it all the time through this story. While the Hebrews won't have him as their liberator, the Midianite girls are only too glad for him when he turns up. And the Midianites were nomads and no one liked them around very much. They just went from one oasis to the next. And here's a group of girls with their father's flock trying to get some water. And the shepherds, they don't want to spare their water with a bunch of nomads. And so they chase them off. But they are more than happy to have Moses as their judge, as their liberator, as their ruler, and accept him. But notice what they think he is. They call him what? An Egyptian, yeah, poor man. Amongst the Egyptians, he's a Jew. Amongst the Jews, he's a nobody. Amongst the Midianites, he's an Egyptian. He's a man with an identity crisis of a fairly severe kind. And so he calls his first son Gershom, which means an alien. That's a nice name for your kid, you know. There's John, there's Peter, there's Alien, there's Fred, there's Bill, you know. You can imagine it in the kind of classroom when they're calling out the role. Is Alien here? And he says, I'm calling him an alien because, and I think the NIV translation doesn't capture it for us because it says, I've become an alien, but it actually is, I was an alien in a foreign land. He says, I was never at home in Egypt. That's my life. You see, he's calling his kid by his own problem. His own problem was he was never at home in Egypt. And he now feels at home in Midian, of all places, because the Midianites are homeless people. That's a good place to feel at home, isn't it? Verses 23, 24, 25, the little section, shows what's happening back in Egypt. Why don't you go for that, Charlie? Right, the action is that the king who wanted to kill the babies, is dead. The people pray, and God hears. What are the two things that motivate God at this point? What are the two things? Sorry? The covenant, yes. He remembers his covenant, his contract, his promise. Right? What's the other thing? The Israelites' prayers. And what about their prayers? What is it that they're praying about? Why are they praying? I missed it. Try to get here. Their slavery. Yeah, the hardships, the groanings. Right, so I've gone that God hears and remembers. And it's a key passage, kind of hinge passage, this one in this part, that the story's rumbling along and now we have God introduced to it. Oh, God was there all along, multiplying and blessing the women, etc., the midwives, but now God hears their prayers of their groanings and their difficulties and he remembers the covenant. And so chapter 3, God starts to take action. Verses 1 to 10, one of the most famous passages of the whole Bible. How about you try that one, Charlie? 1 to 10 of chapter 3. Well, I suppose you've got to call it the burning bush, haven't you? But it's God's revelation, isn't it? God now speaks to his servant because God is coming to rescue. He identifies himself as the God of the patriarchs in verses 4 to 6. Abram, Isaac and Jacob. And he has got a plan for deliverance of the people, which includes Moses, verse 10. I reckon you'd have a sinking feeling when you heard verse 10 if you were Moses. Now Moses raises some objections to this in the next section. We're going to read through from about 3:11 to 4:17, a longer section, where Moses argues with God about it. I'm a little confused here because I've written down Moses has four objections and one refusal. That's what I think is in this next section. But I can only think of three of them at the moment. So maybe my title's wrong. It should be three objections. So what we'll do is after Charlie's read it through for us, we'll get you to identify, as I'll try and read and carefully work it out myself again now, what are his three or four objections and what is his refusal? That's the question you'll be answering once Charlie's finished through to chapter 4, verse 17.
But Moses said to Aaron, bring the Israelites out of Egypt. And God said, I'll be with you. And this one.
It's all right, yes, I left one out. There are four. All right, which ones did you get? What are the four objections? First one?
Who am I?
Who am I? That's right, back in chapter 3, verse 11. Who am I that I should go? And the answer is, I will be with you. You're not going alone. Second question, fairly obvious one that flows from that. Who are you? Yes, that's right, verse 13. And you get that marvellous answer, I am who I am. That's who I am. Somehow that comforts him. Third problem he has. What's the third one? Yeah, they won't believe me. Why would they? I mean, when I murdered someone on their behalf, the Hebrews won't believe me, rather than the Egyptians. They didn't believe me when I tried before. They kicked me out before. Why would they believe me now that I say, oh, look, I was up in the mountain, I met God? Sure. You know, don't we all? And so God gives three answers to that, three miracles. The staff that turns into the snake, the leprosy, the hand that goes in and out of leprosy, and the water turning to blood, isn't it? What's the fourth objection? Yeah, I haven't got much eloquence. I can't speak very clearly, to which God says, who gives anyone speech? I'm the one who created speech and hearing and sight and everything else that's going. And so then he comes to his objection. Send someone else, please. He is a willing missionary, desperate to get to Uruguay. Built into it are the very important details of verses, 16 through to 22 of chapter 3. So that chapter 3, verses 16 to 22, in a sense, I don't know whether you're a Bible marker or not, but that whole paragraph is to be marked in a way of saying, because that in a capsule is really what the book of Exodus is going to be about for the next 10 chapters or so anyway. In some ways further than that. The land of the Canaanites, verse 17, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites and all those others. I don't know whether I can do a map for you here or not, and it'd be a bit tricky without one of these plastic things, and they won't like it if I write on that, will they? So there's a lovely map, isn't it? That's just what we needed. Let's have a go here. Well, if we have the Mediterranean Sea over here and Egypt down there, right, and the Red Sea comes like that over here, does it not? And over here you have the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, right? Don't worry too much about the proportions. There's a scale and there's a title and there's a north point for those geographers who are concerned about these things. This land down here is the land of Egypt, it still is today. This land is the land of Canaan that they are talking about, which at this stage has been occupied for centuries by the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Hittites. Right? That is the land that has been promised to Abram. That is the promised land. And they're going to get out of Egypt and get up into the promised land because it has been promised to them that that would happen when the sins of the Amorites reach their fulfillment, which is about now, according to the story. All right? So, how it's going to happen, though, we're told. You're going to go back and tell the leaders of Israel, and they will believe you. But Pharaoh won't believe you. But don't worry, I've got him in hand. So, and then verses 21 to 22 is interesting. You're going to plunder the land you come out of. The slaves are going to rip off the whole land. All right, we've got Where is it? One more section to go, haven't we? One more section. You think up the title for it as Charlie reads for us, verses 18 to 31. All right? What do you reckon the title's going to be? Tell the person beside you. All right, this is the one I've gone for. Dead simple, wasn't it? That section there in verses 24, 25, 26, that's a headache, isn't it? It's more than a headache to Moses, or to Moses' son. I mean, it's all about him getting back to Egypt. That's fair enough. The title's fair enough, but different events happening. Farewell to Jethro, final instructions from God, and then God wants to kill Moses. Yeah, what on earth's that about? Notice in your NIV, Moses is in brackets there. That is, the Hebrew text, if you read it, says, at a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and was about to kill him. But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched his feet with it. Now, the NIV translators have said, well, Moses is the most likely. It could be his son that is being met, that God was going to kill Gershom, and that's what God, and she touches Gershom's feet with it all. Well, it's a strange little passage, that one, isn't it? One of the weirdest passages of the Bible. Why the uncircumcision? Well, circumcision is a sign of being the covenant people of God. It was a sign that we read elsewhere hadn't really been consistently practiced by the children of Israel during their time down in Egypt. It seems that the Midianite, the Moses' son, if not Moses himself, was uncircumcised. Why the uncircumcision? Well, circumcision is a sign of being the covenant people of God. It was a sign that we read elsewhere hadn't really been consistently practiced by the children of Israel during their time down in Egypt. It seems that the Midianite, the Moses' son, if not Moses himself, was uncircumcised. And God was reaching out to attack him. But notice what he's just said to Pharaoh in verses 22-23. I think the context helps us a little bit with that difficult passage. He has said back in verse 22, Israel is my firstborn. And therefore say to Pharaoh, if you don't let my firstborn go, I'll kill your firstborn. And then, seeing the firstborn of Moses uncircumcised, if it's not Moses himself uncircumcised, God reaches out to kill him. What is a firstborn? A firstborn is very much more important to the ancient world than it is to us. A firstborn is the crown prince. A firstborn is the heir of the world, the heir of your inheritance, is the person who is your future. You still see it in some communities in Sydney, I've noticed, some different ethnic groups in our community, where the child is named after his father's father, after the grandfather. And so the names step down and are repeated every second generation. Because some places they actually call the first child after the father himself in some nations, so that I am never going to go out of existence. That is, there will always, provided I have a son, there will always be a Philip Jensen in existence. So even when I'm gone, Philip Jensen continues, and Philip Jensen continues. And what a lovely thought this is for you to share. You should worry. Think of your children. They've got to put up with him too, you see. And so there's this sense that I am being cut off. God has Israel as his inheritance, as his heir. And if the Pharaoh will not allow his heir to go, then God will kill the Pharaoh's firstborn. More of that, of course, in the coming weeks. Well, there we've read through the chapter. Now, I'd commend to you that next week, we haven't finished the sermon. In fact, we haven't started the sermon. Next week, you do that exercise yourself. Go through chapters 5 to 9 and just divide it up into sections and put a heading on each of them. That is, Bible reading requires attentive minds. Don't just read down and, yeah, I've read that chapter, and none the wiser what it's about. Actually, you have to sit down and think through, what is it saying? The questions at the back should help you do it, but putting a heading on a paragraph is an easy, simple way of getting yourself to understand what the passage is saying. Now, before we turn down the need for liberation through to the model, which will be fairly quick, but it'll take a moment or two, let's have a break by singing a song, shall we? Which one are we going for? Let Us Adore? I haven't got it here. Right, now let's move quickly down this, just alluding to these passages. At first glance, you'd think the need for liberation is obvious. After all, these were people in slavery, but slavery was not viewed as a bad thing in the Old Testament necessarily. But you say, oh, but clearly they are in need of liberation because they were enslaved by a wicked, evil, a totalitarian king who did not know Joseph, who betrayed his previous promises or the previous promises of his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather or of a previous dynasty, whose inhumanity of treatment is appalling. After all, it's almost like genocide, isn't it? All the little boy babies that'll be killed, although it'll be a more effective genocide, I think, if all the little girl babies were killed. However, not that I'm against little girl babies, it's just if you want to do it, then he's doing it the wrong way. You only need one or two men, they're fairly hopeless. It's the girls you've got to keep alive or kill. They're the future. But nonetheless, it's an inhuman treatment, isn't it? It's an appalling way to treat people. But the key to the story is not the horror and inhumanity of the events. The key is who the people are. The Lord hears their groaning in verse 24 and remembers the promises of the covenant. Remembers the promises given to the patriarchs. God is the God of the patriarchs. Over again, you see it, chapter 2, verse 34. There isn't 34 verses. 24. Chapter 2, verse 24, chapter 3, verse 6, chapter 3, verse 15, chapter 3, verse 16, chapter 4, verse 5. I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. I am the God of Jacob. Not I was the God, I am the God of them. God continues in relationship with them in the present tense, and these are his people. He has made covenant with the Israelites, and he is going to make those promises come true. And so in chapter 3, verse 8, notice how it goes. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites. Exactly the same phrase that is used way back in Genesis chapter 15 about the land that he is going to give them. And the same thing is mentioned for us in chapter 3, verse 17. As we read these things, you see, we think it's funny. Why do they keep on saying Canaanites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites? Is it just to put modern readers off? The answer is no. It serves to remind you of which bit of the Bible is being quoted, chapter 15 of Genesis. And you are supposed to remember that as you have read all the way through and read it often. So, in fact, in chapter 4, verse 22-23, the Israelites are God's firstborn. The reason why there must be a liberation is that God's own people are in captivity. But there's another reason even more important. It's not just the humanitarianism. It's not just God's people, who they were that it was in, but it's the fact that God has promised. God has his plans. From the beginning, way back in Genesis, 400 years beforehand, he has promised that the people will be in slavery and he will bring them out. And so, having given the promise of chapter 15, Genesis, God is now going to act to fulfill his covenant and to raise up his prophet, redeeming the people and bringing them into the promised land and so forth. God's plans are actually greater than this. God's plans stretch right through to Jesus. But at this stage, this is the fulfillment that has to take place. Now, throughout the sections we've been reading tonight, the centre person is Moses. From chapter 2 onwards, Moses dominates the rest of the book. Moses is God's chosen liberator of the people. From the beginning, it is noticed that he is a beautiful child. He comes from a priestly family, and his mother saw him as fine, which is a funny thing, because most mothers would say the same. And he is preserved because of this. Acts chapter 7, verse 20, Acts chapter 7, verse 20, and Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, Hebrews 11, 23, we find that they hid him because they saw in him something particularly beautiful, something particularly striking, something particularly impressive. Bob Hawke's mother perceived in the little Bob Hawke that God was giving her a leader for the nation. Isn't that an extraordinary thing? That throughout his life, Bob Hawke was raised being told that God had given him specially to his parents because God had a plan for his life to make him the leader of the nation. It's a pity he doesn't believe in God, isn't it? There's something about the child Moses that attracted the attention so that they were willing to risk life and limb by not killing their child or allowing the Egyptians to kill him, but to save him and rescue him in the way they did. This beautiful child had a beautiful life in the Egyptian home. He grew in the wisdom and the knowledge and the power of the Egyptians. He had everything going for him when his own people were living in slavery. But he is a truly godly person because he retains his Hebrew sympathies. He goes to rescue the slaves and to be caught up with their cause rather than enjoying the delights of the palace surrounds and treasures. We're told in Hebrews chapter 11 again, the point is drawn out of this passage, that he chose rather identification with slaves than the pleasures and privileges of court life. He was so committed to the Christ, to the Hebrew cause, the Christ, that he was willing to risk life and limb. He was willing, indeed, to risk his own condemnation by Pharaoh. He was willing to lose all the wealth of Egypt, which was his, being one of the children of the Pharaoh's daughter. He was willing to lose everything for the sake of a bunch of slaves. That's held up to us in Hebrews. Because it's held as a challenge for us as to what we are willing to lose for the sake of the Christ. That's very important to grasp hold of, because our own little petty incomes, our own little empires, our own little careers, our own little lifestyle, we very often think are a big thing to sacrifice. Moses had it all. The most powerful kingdom in the universe, the Russia or America of that day and age, and he lived in the palace as the Pharaoh's daughter's son. He had it all, but the cause of the Hebrew slaves was much more important to him than all the wealth of Egypt. It's a great challenge to us to remember that. It's meant to be. Hebrews chapter 11, you'll see it worked out. But he is the rejected judge. The Hebrews didn't want him. Who made you judge and rule over us? Jesus actually quotes that in Luke chapter 12, but in another context. That's because he attempted to rescue them, but failed comprehensively. The only thing he got out of Egypt was himself, and just in the nick of time. He thought God was going to be using him. He thought the people would know that God was using him. But they didn't. They wouldn't accept him. Acts chapter 7 picks up this theme out of this passage. They pushed Moses aside and he fled. That is, he was rejected by God's people. And so he's nervous about going back to them later on, even though he's accepted by the Midianites. But more importantly, he's accepted and chosen by God. For what man rejects, God often accepts. What God accepts, man often rejects. Jesus himself was like that, wasn't he? He came into his own, but his own received him not. He quoted that psalm, Psalm 18, that the stone the builders rejected, God has made the head of the corner. Gospel preaching's like that. The Apostle Paul preached the gospel first to the Jews, but the Jews rejected it. And so he turned to the Gentiles, the pagans, who accepted it gladly. at the end of the book of Acts, Acts chapter 28, verses 26 to 28, Acts 28, 26 to 28, he quotes Isaiah 6, how the people of God will not accept the things of God, whereas the outsiders who are not the people of God accept gladly the things of God. Now that we become the people of God, we must take the warning seriously, for the people of God have an incredible record of rejecting God's prophetic word to them. Stephen brings up this challenge, and that's why Stephen uses Moses as a sermon illustration in Acts chapter 7, just before he gets himself killed. That he says, "You people always resist the Holy Spirit. Was there ever a prophet your fathers didn't persecute?" Even the greatest of all the prophets, Moses, was rejected by the people of God. But he was God's chosen messenger. And so chapter 3 verse 10, "I am sending you." Even when Moses didn't want to go, he was going because God had chosen him. Funny thing, isn't it? See, Moses was eager to rescue the people, but he was doing it without God, and he achieved nothing. Later on, he was very reluctant to go back and rescue the people, but he did it with God, and he achieved everything. That's because the real liberator is not Moses, the real liberator is God. And while Moses may occupy the front of the scene, if you actually understand the story, Moses doesn't do much without God. What he does is nearly always wrong. "For God is the sovereign ruler over all things, over all the events of the Exodus. He prospers the midwives, he hears and saw and knew about the state of the Israelites there. He controls the events, he foretells the future. He works his miraculous signs in and through Moses. God, who is the sovereign Lord, is not like the Queen of England, or as she really is, the Queen of Australia, remote and powerless, a symbolic, theoretical sovereign. God is the God who acts. He takes action. He's the King who acts to rescue his people, to come to Moses, to call Moses, to equip Moses, to direct Moses, to win the battles for Moses. God actually does it. And more, God not only acts, but he reveals himself and his plans and his name, his reputation, his character in the burning bush. He is the God who is. I am who I am." The name Yahweh, YHWH, the name Yahweh is a compressed form of the verb to be in Hebrew. I can't explain it better than that, because of my poor Hebrew and your lack of Hebrew. But it all has to do with the verb to be. That is, God's name is. If you like, God's name is. That help you any? He is the God. He is the God who is. He is the present tense God. He is not the past tense God. You see, the children of Israel were tempted when they were in slavery to think that the God of the fathers was not as powerful as the God of the Egyptians, to think that the God of Abram must have fallen asleep or was dead and passed away like Joseph, or only operated in Palestine, or was remote and uncaring or forgetful of his promises, or maybe didn't keep his promises. But the answer is no, I am the God who is. I am. Maybe I will be who I will be. I am the living one who is answerable to no one, Moses. Jesus walked across the water in the midst of the storm. The disciples were terrified. And as Jesus got into the boat and the storm stills, he says, "Take courage. I am." If you weren't scared enough of the storm, if you weren't scared enough of a bloke who walks on the water, what would you do with a man who calls himself I am if you were Jewish? They were astonished, we read in Mark chapter 6. Reckon. He has a big fight with the Jews in chapter 8 of John's Gospel about Abram. And he concludes by saying, "Before Abraham was, I am." They picked up stones to stone him to death for such blasphemy as to take upon himself the name of God, the one who is. And the book of Revelation continually talks about God as the one who was and is to come. And Jesus, arguing with the Sadducees about the resurrection, says, God is not the God of the dead, but remember the burning bush incident. He didn't say, I was the God of Abram, I was the God of Jacob, I was the God of Isaac. He says, I am. Because those men haven't been failed by God. They are still alive. God continues to rescue them. God is not the God of the past tense, but of the present. He is the one who is God. And he continues to be the God of Abram because Abram has been resurrected. What we have here really is the beginning of the model of liberation. For Christianity is not ethics. It's not morality. It's not rules and regulations. Christianity is liberation. Christianity is freedom. It's rescuing. It's saving. And it's the model that we have before us is a whole pattern that the Bible keeps referring to. When the children of Israel went into captivity in Babylon, many, many years later, centuries later, 600 or so years later, the whole story of the Exodus comes to life again, and they're told a new Exodus is going to take place. God will meet you out in the wilderness again. And he'll do it all over again. And when Jesus is on the Mount of Transfiguration, talking with Moses and Elijah, what is he talking about? He's talking, we're told in Luke's Gospel, about his Exodus. That's what he's talking about. For Jesus comes, like Moses, to rescue the slaves from the oppressor. By a supernatural deliverance of God, he was to purchase the people through the death of the firstborn of God. By the death of that Passover lamb himself, he was to rescue the people out of their slavery to sin and bring them into the promised land, the heavenly city of Jerusalem that is above. All the concepts by which we understand Jesus come from the Exodus, the tabernacle, the priest, the sacrifice, Sinai, the law, the wilderness, the prophecy and a prophet, the Passover, the covenant. They're all the Exodus events. For that great liberation takes place. The gospel is a liberation of people. That is, if you're not an abstract thinker, I don't know how you're here if you're not, but if you're not, and you want to put it into a concrete to understand, you want a physical image of what Jesus was doing, well, we do not set up a statue, because that'll lead you to idolatry. God sets up an event. And the event was a wicked person who held the people of God in slavery, till God sent his rescuer down amongst them. And through the Passover lamb being sacrificed, took them out of the land of slavery across a wilderness wandering for a whole generation until he brought them into his promised land. That is what Jesus is all about. For we are held in captivity and slavery to sin and bondage to sin and death under all the oppression of a fallen world. And God has sent into our world a Saviour, a liberator, a rescuer, who through the death of the Lamb, through the remarkable resurrection event, has rescued us out of our slavery. And now, in the rest of our life, the rest of our generation, we wander in the wilderness. That's where we're up to at the moment, friends. We're still wandering in the wilderness as we head towards the promised land that lies before us, in relationship with God. The human liberator was Moses. He was a great one, the greatest one of the Old Testament, you could say. And because of such, he was persecuted by his own people. Because of such, he chose mistreatment rather than the pleasures of Egypt. He rejected the treasures and he didn't fear the king. And so we have a model in Moses that we should follow. We should expect to be persecuted, and even by our own people, And we should be willing to accept mistreatment for the sake of something greater. And we should be willing to sacrifice all to live in the squalor of Uruguay for the sake of the gospel of saving people. We've got to be happy to reject all things, and we mustn't be fearful of the king. Now, all those things are true. But Moses is only a model of the real human liberator, Jesus. And as you reflect upon the life of Jesus, you'll see more and more parallels with Moses. After all, if you remember, there was a king at the time of Jesus who said that you've got to kill all the little baby boys, called Herod. And do you remember where Jesus' parents took him to rescue him? To Egypt, of all places. He was rejected by Israel, and he was accepted by the Gentiles and the Samaritans. He was chosen by God. Moses, we're told, was faithful in the household of God as a servant, but Jesus was faithful as a son. Jesus, for the joy that lay before him, endured the shame of the crucifixion. And yet in all this, the real liberator is God. For God planned our rescue before the creation of the world. He knows how our captivity and our hardship. He hears our prayers and complaints, our groans and our longings as we live in a sinful, fallen world. And we mustn't think he's fallen asleep, because he keeps his promises. He will return. He will bring the world to an end with a new heavens and a new earth. And in the meantime, he has already sent for us that Passover lamb, so that we can cross the wilderness cared for by him, following someone who's better than Moses, Jesus. For the power of the evil one has been broken, as Pharaoh's of old has been broken. It's all a massive visual aid for us to understand the gospel of Jesus. And Moses is the Jesus figure, but a pale reflection of the real Jesus. Well, it was long because you didn't do the exercise of reading beforehand, because you weren't told to. So we won't go for question time now. I'll be here and happy to answer questions for you privately, because it's too late to go for it now. Next week, chapters 5 to 9. It's easy reading. It's narrative reading. But do make sure you do it before we come, shall you, and we get further down the track. We're going to sing one more. We don't have Guide Me Out of Jake and Hover, do we? All right.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.